On October 20th, 2006, Resurgence held an event called The Story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Our speaker for the event was Dr. Martin Abegg, professor at Trinity Western University and the Dead Sea Scrolls Institute. To make this lecture more useful, you can find notes as well as Q&A audio to this lecture online at theresurgence.com.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to see you all here. I think I can see you all. It's kind of like being in the headlights up here. You know, it's amazed me. I've been doing this for almost 20 years now, and I think that Seattle has really put the Dead Sea Scrolls over the top. I am just amazed how many people I've run into in Seattle that are so keen to see, hear about, read about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it never ceases to amaze me how, you know, my colleagues at Trinity Western in the Religious Studies Department, they don't have this kind of crowd come out when they talk about their various areas of expertise. I think they're a little jealous, actually, but hopefully you're not here to see me, right? We're here to see the scrolls, and I did hear Gary ask you all about how many of you had gone to see the exhibit. I didn't see the hands, but he said it was just a smattering, if I caught his comment correctly. And so hopefully after our evening together, you will be so impressed and so turned on by the scrolls that you'll run right down there and take advantage of what is at the exhibit, because it's a very nice exhibit. You really need to see it while it's here in town. So enough advertisement. Let's get going here. The first slide that I have to show you really picks up on this whole area of interest. You know, what is it that turns us on about the Dead Sea Scrolls? And a student brought me this clipping, and it comes from The Sun, not the Vancouver Sun. I'm up by Vancouver, but that you know, that rag that you pick up by the grocery counter. And if you've followed those, I don't, you know, but my students do. If you follow those things, you know that the Dead Sea Scrolls turn up occasionally. And there's another character that turns up occasionally, too, and it was only a matter of time when the Sun would put the two together. So we have amazing predictions in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and yes, you've got it. Elvis is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It says here, and I don't think you can probably read it, but it talks about various things that were predicted in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and all of these are hogwash, by the way, so don't believe any of it. But it says the scrolls predict that Jerusalem and not Megiddo will be the site of the last battle on the earth. There's several other things like that. I don't even want to read you because I don't want to put these things in your head. But it drops down to the end of the first column, and it says, but the strangest revelation, and that's the word, the strangest revelation of the Dead Sea Scrolls pertains to the modern-day prophet named Elvis. Yes. One of the fragments found in the cave spells out the name Elvis, says Dr. Shields, whoever he is. And it goes on from there to talk about how Elvis is a prophet and he's fabled for his song and gospel and all that sort of thing. So Elvis and the Dead Sea Scrolls, yes. I don't even know how you would spell Elvis in Hebrew. That's a tough one, actually. If you know Hebrew, it doesn't work very well. But Elvis is not in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I think this sort of thing gives evidence as to the kind of things we expect to see in the scrolls. Not Elvis, but we expect great things, right? So this evening, just want to spend the next hour and plus, and then leave plenty of time for you to ask questions, and so be thinking about that as we go. Some of the best discussions come from audience questions. We'll be talking about just what is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, why are they important? Why are we interested in them? And so that's what we'll head into now. Actually, this pretty much captures it right here. This is a Shemuel Yahu Talmon. He's a professor at the Hebrew University where I began my studies. And he wrote this. He says, the scrolls promise to give some help for partly inscribing the proverbial blank page between the Hebrew Bible and the Mishnah, on one hand. Now, this is the Jewish community we're talking about. I spoke for the Jewish Federation last night, and this is where they are, the Hebrew Bible and the Mishnah on one hand, and between the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament on the other. So this paints the picture quite broadly. The scrolls are of great interest and great importance for both Jews and Christians, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, as to why they're important. Just a little bit of Dead Sea Scrolls 101 before we get going here so that we have a context in which to place all this new information. And it's a reminder for me to tell you that the exhibit that is at the Science Center does a great job, the first part of the exhibit working up to the scrolls, setting this sort of context. In fact, the scrolls are normally on exhibit at the Shrine of the Book or the Palestinian Archaeological Museum, or the what is currently known as the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. And I think that the exhibit here in Seattle does a much better job kind of preparing you for the context in which to understand the scrolls than the museums in Israel do. They could learn, I think, from what the Science Center has done here. But just to talk a little bit, first of all, about the term Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, certainly they weren't found in the Dead Sea, right? I get that question occasionally. How did they survive all those years in the Dead Sea? Well, they weren't found in the Dead Sea. They were found in caves just above the Dead Sea at the northwest corner, most of them. But the term Dead Sea Scrolls actually refers to a much larger group of materials than we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about just a small part of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's that part really that is focused on at the Science Center. There are a number of sites in the Judean wilderness that that fall under this category, Dead Sea Scrolls, and they really vary quite a bit in age as well. We have Samaritan papyri that date back to the time of Alexander the Great, so this is 4th century B.C., quite old, 2,400 years. We have materials that were found in a cave at Wadi Murabat. This is Second Jewish Revolt material at the other end of the spectrum. Second Jewish Revolt was in the 2nd century A.D. So we've got 500 to 600 years of time span that that are encompassed by the larger find termed Dead Sea Scrolls. We can walk down the coast of the Dead Sea. We have a site at Nahal Chever, also Second Jewish Revolt material. Nahal Tze'elim, also Second Jewish Revolt. This is a site that that many of you are aware of, I'm sure. This is Masada. And you probably didn't know that there were scrolls also found at Masada. Not a lot, but a few. And they're directly related to the scrolls that are on display at the Science Center, same time period. And that brings us to that very site. This site here is called Qumran. It is just a day's walk from Jerusalem, a day's walk south of Jericho. In a car, you can actually drive from Jerusalem down to the archaeological site at Qumran in under an hour. It's quite close. Qumran is the site where the scrolls that are at the museum were found, and that's the site we're going to center in on tonight. Those are the scrolls that, when we say Dead Sea Scrolls, most of us are thinking of the scrolls that came from this very site. Okay, so let's focus in on this site. Here's a little closer view. And there were 11 caves that were found at this particular site at Wadi Qumran. Cave number one, and that's the one that you probably are aware of the story, the shepherd boy throwing the rock in the cave, hearing the tinkling of pottery, coming back the next day and finding not gold, not silver, not a genie, but scrolls. That was 1947, cave one was found. And there is the diamond. You can see that location. Cave 11 was the last of the manuscript caves, and it was found in 1956. So these 10 years were really the fruitful period for the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and questions often come as to have archaeologists attempted to find more, and you can bet they have. They've been combing the hillsides using ground-penetrating radar, any sort of technology that they can bring to bear on the task, and they haven't found very much. In fact, as far as manuscript material, they've found almost nothing. It was these 10 years, back in the late 40s to the mid-50s, where the scrolls were found, and that is the material that we're dealing with still today. So Cave 11, you can see the diamond there. It's almost the northernmost cave. Cave 3 was the northernmost. That is the cave that the copper scroll came out of that is on display in facsimile at the center. So how many, we're going to be dealing with numbers a bit here. Numbers, I love numbers, and numbers are easy to deal with, easy to understand, and we can tell some very interesting stories with these numbers. So it won't be just math and that sort of thing. We'll actually get into some so what sort of questions. 900 manuscripts came out of these 11 caves. 706 came out of Cave 4. So that was the mother lode. If you go to the archaeological site, this is the one that you can see, and this is the one that I'll show you a picture in a few minutes. Normally, this is the picture that you see, Cave 4, which is was found in 1952. Now, just a warning, if you're taking down notes here and copy down these numbers, you'll find that when you go to the Science Center, almost none of the numbers that I have here agree. You know, so who's right, ABEG or the Science Center? Actually, we tried to change the numbers in the exhibit, and the IAA, the Israel Antiquities, was very, very conservative in their changing. And by the time we got the okay, it was too late. You know, all of the banners and everything had already been printed. So the numbers that you'll see here are right up to date, you know, as early as last week, which tells you a little bit about scroll research. We're not even sure. We're getting surer by the day, but we're not even sure how many manuscripts we're dealing with. You know, and if you take a look at the exhibit as you walk in, one of the things that the Science Center has is a box of 50,000 puzzle pieces. Think of that as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And how many manuscripts are in there? Well, it's a little bit hard to tell at times. You know, it depends on how you put the puzzles together. But this is what we think we have, 900 manuscripts, 706 from Cave 4. So let's dig a little deeper in this this particular numbers game here. We can subdivide those 900 into biblical manuscripts. We have 206 biblical scrolls, of which there are five on display at the Science Center. So you can see we've got about, what, 2 or 3% of the material that's here in Seattle. Five Greek manuscripts. So that these are the oldest manuscripts of the Bible that is known as the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. Now, this number, we don't want to pass by too quickly here. This number says something very, very interesting and important about this particular group. Now, if you have 900 books at home on your shelves, do you have 206 Bibles? That's a lot of Bibles. So this group is a very, very biblically centered group. You know, they are, the Bible was the center of their life. It was what they looked to daily for their Jewish existence. And even those scrolls that are not Bibles, the other 700 or so, are focused on the Bible. We have no letters, no novels, no newspapers, no marriage certificates, no inventory lists, shopping lists, anything of that sort. Everything is focused on the Bible. So we have hymn books, we have legal discussions, we have commentaries, we have community rules, which tells us how the community lived and how you would join and how you would stay a member in good standing. So everything focused on the Bible. So it is worthy of emphasizing that, because this is a very biblically centered group. We can break this down by language, and this tells a very interesting story as well. We have 133 of those that are not Bibles now. The Bibles are as they are, either Hebrew or Aramaic, depending on the book. But of the non-biblical scrolls, 133 of them are Aramaic. Okay? 550 are Hebrew. Now, if you had done any reading, especially looking back at the handbooks that were printed maybe before 1960, about the language of Jesus or the language of the Jewish community at the time of Jesus, it's likely that the handbook would have said that the language that Jesus spoke was what? Aramaic, right. If you saw the movie The Passion, you know that's the movie, that's the language that Jesus spoke for the most part. So this very figure has opened up that whole discussion again. Now, Mel wasn't aware of that, or he would have had Jesus speaking a little bit more Hebrew, perhaps. I had a very good question that came up last week at the town hall lecture that I gave in Seattle, and someone asked, well, this is a religious community. Maybe these are their worship materials, you know, so that they would have been speaking Hebrew in the synagogue, so to speak, but maybe spoke Aramaic outside. And that's very possible, but we do have some scrolls that that are written in the type of Hebrew that would have been more or less, you know, the spoken variety. We have, I said there were no letters. Actually, we do have one letter available in six copies that seems to have been written by the leader of the scroll group to the high priest in Jerusalem. And what language did he write that in? He wrote it in Hebrew. We have a copper scroll that lists some 64 sites where treasure was to be buried. Now, I'll tell you, I think that scroll is not connected to the others, but nonetheless, it's written in Hebrew. Now, all of that says that Hebrew may have been more the street language of the day than perhaps we had given credence to before. Scholars would have said prior to the discovery of the scrolls that Aramaic was the language. Aramaic was the lingua franca, but it appears from the scrolls that Hebrew was had not died as we had thought it had. And the last group, 22 Greek sectarian manuscripts. Now, this says something very interesting about this group. They were trilingual, more or less. At least they could read in three languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. So I think we have a tendency to look back at the ancients, 2,000 years ago, and we think, we're smart. They must have been dumb in some way. We've come a long way in 2,000 years, but don't you believe it. These guys... how many of you are trilingual? That is not the kind of community we live in. This is a very interesting cross-section here that we see, and these fellows were no dummies. Okay, so that's the numbers game. Now we're going to move in. I'll just show you a little bit about more context to understand the material that we're going to be talking about, looking at particular scrolls and talking about the Bible and the non-Bible scrolls. First of all, we need to establish a very important aspect before we move on, the dating. Now, dating is important because if this material that came from the caves at Qumran was medieval, which many believed it was when we go back to the 50s. In fact, I had a professor at the Hebrew Union College where I did my PhD. And in fact, Danny Wiener, who is the rabbi at Temple Dehersh Sinai here in town. Danny Wiener studied with Professor Rivkin, and Professor Rivkin believed this material was from the medieval period. It couldn't have been as old as many of the scholars were saying at that time. So we need to establish the date, because if it's medieval, it's not nearly as important to us as if it were, the time of Jesus or before. And why is that? Because it's too late. It tells us after the fact rather than before. For the Jewish community, we don't get the roots of Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, that we'd like to see. For the Christian community, we don't get the backdrop to the New Testament that we'd like to see. So dating is very important. So just a few things about dates. The first attempts to date were done by paleography. Now, paleography is just a fancy word for handwriting. And as you go to the exhibit, you'll see a very nice display on handwriting. You can actually try your hand at dating the Dead Sea Scrolls. I like to think of my own context here, and my handwriting is a lot different than my mother's handwriting. My dad doesn't have a handwriting. My dad prints. But I go back to my grandmother and my grandfather's handwriting, and that was different still. In fact, you can see a rather downhill progression from my grandmother to my mother to me. And in fact, my older daughter writes so poorly that I ask her to send emails to me even when she's in the house, because I cannot read her handwriting. And you probably have a similar thing going on in your life, I would imagine, too. So you can see that that handwriting, even in our context, evolves, and it was no different in antiquity. So the scholars that study this sort of thing, they say they can date a piece of written material to within 25 years based on the letter forms. Now, maybe that's a little hyperbolic, but certainly 50 is not a problem. And the handwriting experts, judging by the dates that we have of other materials, now I need to tell you there are no dates on any of the scrolls, absolutely no dates. Many ancient manuscripts, when the scribe finishes it, his job, he'll say, "Thanks be to God, I'm done," and go take a break. But nothing like that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have to date it by other means, and by handwriting, by comparing it to other things that we have from from a similar time period, from sites in a similar area, we get these dates: 250 BCE or 250 BC. To 50 CE or 50 AD. Okay? Archaeology. In another couple of weeks, Jody Magnus is going to be speaking at Town Hall Lectures. She's one of the foremost archaeologists in the Dead Sea Scrolls research today. And she'll tell us about various dating techniques. And there really are two that we need to be aware of. First, at the center, you'll see a very nice collection of coins. Coins are really nice because they have dates on them, right? So a coin found in an archaeological site is probably the best means of dating. Clay pots, you know, or jars. There is an evolution of that sort of material, just like there is of handwriting. So with those two bits of data or types of dating techniques, we get these dates with the archaeology: 223 BC to 70 AD. About the same period of time, and that's what we're going to be seeing here as we walk through this this slide. More recently, and in fact, radiocarbon dating first came to the fore at about the same time the scrolls were found. But you needed to burn up so much material that you'd have practically had to destroy a whole scroll to get a date for it, and no scholar was interested in doing that, to lose his scroll just to date it. So they would date the linen wrappers or other materials that were found in the caves. But more recently, and in the 90s, there were two tests done. More recently, the amount of material that needs to be destroyed to get a valid date has really gotten very small. I mean, we're talking about milligrams. And there were two tests done, one in Tulsa, one in Zurich, in the 90s that gave this range of dates, 209 BC to 80 AD. So you can see, again, very similar dates. We can look at historical figures that are mentioned in the scrolls. You know, you open up your newspaper today, you read about current events. Very similar sort of thing going on here. They mentioned very few historical figures, but those that they did mention date to this period, 175 BC to 40 BC. So again, very similar time. And in fact, there are a couple of scrolls where they actually date themselves. They say that our community started 390 years plus 40 years after the destruction of the temple, that sort of thing. So we get a date like 177 BC as a result of that. The importance of this is that no matter how we come at the dating issue, we get about the same figures. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, just to paint in broad strokes here, the oldest of the scrolls date to the middle of the 3rd century, or about 250 BC, and the youngest of them date to about the middle of the 1st century AD, or about 50. So 250 years before the birth of Christ and 50 years after the birth of Christ. And now we've got our parameters, and they are so important, because this material gives us a window into a time period that before the discovery of the scrolls, we had no firsthand information for. So, backdrop of Christianity, the early church, the origins of rabbinic Judaism, you know, those two religions that really have formed the culture that we enjoy here in the West, date back to this time. So not only the religions that we find ourselves adhering to still to this day, Judaism and Christianity, but also the culture. And I think that is, especially in the Seattle area, one of the things that people find so fascinating about the scrolls. You know, this culture that we enjoy here in the West dates back to this time. Here's where the thinking began. So a very important time period. Just a couple of pictures to give you some visuals here. This is Cave 1, and I can do a fancy thing here with the pen. This is the place where the Bedouin boy crawled through, this hole right up in here. These holes down here were opened up by the archaeologists later, and as I first saw this cave about 20 years ago, and the holes keep getting bigger and bigger every year. I think one of these years the whole front is going to fall in. But interestingly enough, this cave is not marked. You have to find it with a map and a compass. There's no sign in front of this cave that says, here's where the most important archaeological find of the 20th century came from. You know, nothing like that. It's pretty weird, actually. And it's part of the adventure, I think. You've actually got to go out and find this cave. And it took me about 4 or 5 hours the first time I went up to look for it. And it gets lost every now and again, too. I can't find it on occasion. But this is the kind of thing that came out of Cave 1, the Great Isaiah Scroll, which this is what we think of. You know, we think Dead Sea Scrolls, something that you can actually roll out. This scroll is almost 30 feet long, and it contains every chapter of Isaiah, all 66 chapters. It's only missing a few words, you know, where there are some wormholes or some rot in the material. But the material is so good, as the story goes, the Bedouins thought they could sell it in Jerusalem or Bethlehem for sandal straps. which thankfully they didn't. I think that's a bit of an apocryphal story, by the way, but it's a very beautiful scroll and is still beautiful to this very day. So that came out of Cave 1 and is probably what we think of when we think Dead Sea Scrolls. However, this is Cave 4. This is the cave that you can see from the archaeological site at Qumran. And from Cave 4 came fragments. We have no entire scrolls that came out of Cave 4. The scrolls in Cave 1 were stored in jars. They were protected. The materials that came out of Cave 4 were buried in the floor. They were probably in shelves on the wall in antiquity, fell down, stuff from the ceiling, bat guano, you name it, buried the material in the floor. And this is what we have to deal with from Cave 4. So when you go into the exhibit at the Science Center and you see that box of 50,000 puzzle pieces, think of this picture and imagine trying to put all this together. So I can imagine that one of you has in mind a question to ask. Why did it take so long to publish the Dead Sea Scrolls? They were found in 1947 to 1956. If you know anything about the story, there were only 7 volumes of material that had been published up to about 1995. And from that time forward, we've got almost 30 volumes that have come out. 1991 marks the date when the Dead Sea Scrolls were more or less let out of their prison. Up until that time, very few scholars hunkered down working on them. But since that time, the scrolls have been opened up to the larger research community, and we're almost done with the publication at this point. Just 2 volumes left. One volume of the Isaiah materials, ironically, and another volume of Aramaic materials. So the question, why did it take so long? Well, you can see. It's very difficult material to deal with, and to begin with, there were just too few people working on the material. Okay, now we're going to move into 2 areas of discussion, actually 3 tonight, because I've got a little bit more time, I think, than I usually do. Hopefully you have the patience as well, because I think we're going to go for about another 50 minutes or so. So kind of take a deep breath, and we're going to dive in. Okay, so we're going to talk about 3 things now that we've got a bit of context. We're going to talk about Bible. And what do the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us about the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament? We're going to talk about Jesus. You know, what do the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us about Jesus? Was he there? And then we're going to talk about a few of the scrolls, the non-biblical scrolls that are on display at the Science Center, depending on how much time, might stretch out, might do that very quickly. But stories of the Seattle Dead Sea Scrolls, more or less. So first of all, Bible. We can ask a number of questions about the scrolls, or of the scrolls, about the Bible. I think this is one that probably comes pretty near the top of the list. Were the same books in the Bible 2,000 years ago as we have today? And more or less, we're going to center in on the Hebrew Bible, the Bible of the Jewish community, which is the same as the Bible, at least the same contents as the Bible for the Protestant Church. Catholic Bible, we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, but we're going to start with the Hebrew Bible, or the Protestant Bible. And before we get into that, I just want to emphasize one thing here, because I think it's so important, and it surprises me to this very day. I sometimes think I must have missed a class someplace along the line, because it can't be true what I'm going to tell you right now. The oldest Hebrew Bible that is available to us today to translate. In fact, the very manuscript that all of our English translations come from, whether the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, or the NIV, or the NRSV, or the New King James, they all date back, they all are based on this one manuscript, a manuscript that is called the Leningrad Codex. And this manuscript dates to 1008 AD. 1008 AD. It's not even 1,000 years old. In fact, we'll have a birthday, 1,000-year birthday, in just a couple of years. So that gives you some inkling as to the importance of the scrolls. For we didn't go back just another 100 years or another 200 years. We went back over 1,000 years in one fell swoop. So from that Bible that we have from 1008, we have now jumped back 2,000 years to the period of the time of Jesus and before. And we can ask questions that we were never able to ask before. And I think this is the first one. This is where we'll start. So same books in the Bible. I'm going to put up a number of slides here to give you some idea of the find, you know, so that you've got some absolute numbers in mind. And there are two columns here. The first column, the one in the middle here, this represents quotations in the non-biblical manuscripts. And that's important because these quotations give us some idea of how they thought about these books. Were they authoritative? And they quote these books in the way, "Thus says the Lord," or "So it says in the books of Moses," or "The prophet Isaiah says," that sort of thing. And they certainly lean on these books as authoritative. In the right-hand column here, we have the total number of biblical manuscripts found in the caves. Right, so that 206 figure that I gave you a bit ago, here we're breaking it down book by book. And we can read through here. But before we begin, let me just ask you one question. What do you know about this already? What book or books was not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Esther, right. The book of Esther was not found. Actually, there were two others, and we'll see that as we go through, and we'll have a little story when we get to those. And I'll tell you about Esther as well. You can see, starting with the Pentateuch, or the five books of Moses, or the Torah, many names, you can see that we're in very good shape. This community loved this section of the Bible. 29 copies of Deuteronomy, man alive, 29 out of 900. How many books do you have where you have 29 copies sitting on your shelf? You know, that would say something about you, a bit crazy, right? 29 copies of Deuteronomy. We move on to what we think of as the historical books, or the former prophets in some sense here. These books are not as popular among the sect. You can see that as quotations, they're only quoting 1 and 2 Samuel and Joshua, which we could spend some time, if we had the time, to talk about that. It's very interesting why they quote those books. But you can see on the manuscript side that things are in pretty good shape. We have a copy of at least one of each of those books, except for Nehemiah. And in fact, I have 1 and 2 Chronicles listed as 1, 2, and you'll see that's in yellow as well. So Nehemiah, no copies of Nehemiah were found. So that goes right along with Esther. However, Ezra was found, and so we assume many of us, there's a bit of a debate here, but we assume as Ezra, so Nehemiah. It's kind of a dynamic duo, right? Kind of the Batman and Robin of antiquity. You know, so Batman is there, Robin can't be far behind, right? So Nehemiah, we assume, was there, and it was just tasty to caveworms. 1 and 2 Chronicles, we have one little piece of 2 Chronicles, and the division of these two books is somewhat of an artificial one. It certainly wasn't divided in antiquity, or if it was two scrolls, we don't know that it was always divided in the same place. So we assume that 2 Chronicles means that 1 Chronicles preceded. So everything here except Nehemiah, and there is an explanation for that. Move into the prophets, and you can see that, again, we're in very good shape. This crew really liked the prophets. And we have 35 quotations of Isaiah, 21 manuscripts. And similarly, 6, 4, you can do the math yourself, going down to the minor prophets with 8. So we're in good shape there. Moving into the writings. Again, you can see that Esther comes up 0, goose egg at the top of the page there. But look at the Psalms. Man, 35 copies of the Psalms. They really loved the Psalms. So what about Esther? Is this just a coincidence as well? You know, is there a partner to Esther that would say that this book was likely in? Well, it would seem that the answer to that is that Esther was out. And the reason we know that with some definitiveness is the fact that we do have calendars that were found in the caves as well. In fact, one of the manuscripts at the Science Center is a calendar, 4Q325, came from cave 4, Q is Qumran, the 325th manuscript from that cave. And those calendars, there are about 20 of them, list all of the festival days, the Sabbaths, the day of the week that the festivals occurred on, the various priestly courses that would serve in the temple, and guess which festival is never listed in any of the calendars? Purim, right. So Purim gets its origin in the book of Esther, so we assume that Esther was not in their canon. It was not in their Bible. And in fact, I could show you a slide. I didn't include it here, but there is a very interesting conversation that goes on in one of the Talmuds where the rabbis say there are 45 male prophets, there are 7 female prophets, and none of them ever say anything to contradict the Torah text, apart from the reading of the scroll of Purim on from Esther. So that that says that even in the rabbinic community, there was a bit of a debate about Esther, and these guys voted no, obviously. So here's the Bible as we know it. Now let's ask the question about the Catholic Bible, the Deuterocanonical books, the Apocrypha. Were they found in the Dead Sea Scrolls? And the answer is yes. There were three of the Apocrypha that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Tobit, Ben Sira, or as known in the Catholic Bible as Ecclesiasticus, and the letter of Jeremiah. And very, very exciting find, actually, because none of these books were available in Hebrew or Aramaic before the discovery of the scrolls. We had them in Greek and other languages, but not in Hebrew and Aramaic. In fact, Tobit, there was a great debate as to which language it was originally written in. Was it originally written in Greek? Well, most scholars didn't think so. But was it Aramaic? Was it Hebrew? And now we've got Aramaic and Hebrew, so the debate goes on. Not all questions are answered, unfortunately. Okay, so that kind of expands the canon a bit, but we haven't completed the question here. Maybe there were other books that they liked that were part of their canon, that were authoritative to them, that we have decided to exclude. Either the rabbis or the church fathers have left on the side table. And indeed, there are two books that come under this category. One is the Book of Jubilees, which is more or less a retelling of the patriarchal stories from Genesis and Exodus. And you can see 15 manuscripts of Jubilees. And in fact, six times the title of this book was quoted in various of their documents as authoritative, as it says in the Book of Jubilees, that sort of thing. And Enoch. Now, Enoch is actually quoted in the New Testament. Do you know the book where it's quoted? The Book of Jude, right. So in the early church, it would appear that Enoch was held in high regard. And in fact, the North African church, or the Ethiopic church, still considers Enoch and Jubilees as a fact to be canonical. I was talking to one of the rabbis at Temple de Hirsch Sinai last night, and she told me that the Ethiopian Jews that have come into Israel in the last couple of decades also consider Jubilees and Enoch to be quite important. So very interesting books. Enoch is kind of like Revelation on steroids. You know, we've got 110-some chapters. It's a wild affair. I might want to take a look at it. Jubilees, if you love the patriarchal stories, you might want to read the Book of Jubilees. Some very interesting additions to the stories that we find in the Book of Jubilees. Okay, so same books in the Bible, yes, but there's a footnote to that, right? It would appear that on one side, Esther, a little bit smaller. On the other side, it would appear that they were still accepting some books that the rabbis and the church fathers decided were not canonical. And this is a great surprise. This actually has created, as you can imagine, great interest in the scholarly community. We've stepped back before the time that the rabbis and the church fathers made the decisions that we still live by today in line with the canon that we accept in our various churches and synagogues today. So we've gone back behind that time period and entered into the debate, as it were. We see these decisions being made right before our eyes. Next question we could ask is this. Same yellow pages. Do you understand that terminology? I used to talk about, when I was in Campus Crusade, talked about the yellow pages because, all of the New Testament side of our Bibles was quite well thumbed, but the Old Testament, they were the white pages. So I thought I'd do something about that, so I centered in my studies on the Old Testament side, always going against the grain a little bit. So same yellow pages. This opens up a very interesting discussion, actually, and we're going to do kind of a David Letterman thing sort of thing here. So if you've got some drums back there, maybe somebody wants to come up and get the number one here. We'll just count down, and you may have remembered some of the numbers, and you already know the top few, I'm sure. But let's just work down here. Minor prophets, we have 8. Number 10, Daniel's 8 at number 9. Leviticus at number 8. Exodus 7. Jubilees. Wow. Number 6. And there's Enoch at number 5. Genesis is number 4. Isaiah. Anyone remember what the next one would be? Deuteronomy, right? And how about the top of the list? Psalms, right. They love the Psalms. So now you can see we've got plenty of space there on the right. So I'm going to bring in a couple of other lists here. And the first one that we can look at is the New Testament. Now we have to compare a little bit apples and oranges here, okay? Because we don't have manuscripts to deal with when we talk about the New Testament. But we do have quotations in the New Testament that gives us some idea of the what books the New Testament writers were reading, right? So we can compare those to the books, the scrolls that were found at Qumran. And we'll see some very interesting things here. Proverbs at number 10, Jeremiah, then Daniel, Leviticus, the Minor Prophets, Genesis, Exodus. You can see how this compares to the left. There's Deuteronomy. What do you think number two is? Isaiah. And how about number one? Psalms, right? That's a little bit of a surprise, maybe. Psalms, top of the list. Okay, now we still have some air to the right there, so we can bring in another text, and this time we're going to bring in the Mishnah. Now, probably some of us aren't too familiar with this book, but this is we could say it's comparable in some ways to the New Testament for the church. The Mishnah is to the New Testament as the Hebrew Bible is to the Old Testament. Okay, if you remember Talmon's comment at the beginning for the rabbis, it's between the Hebrew Bible and the Mishnah. For the church, it's between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So the Mishnah also has quotations, and we can bring those in here. We have Ezekiel at number 10, Minor Prophets, Proverbs, Isaiah, boy, a bit off the top there. And notice the numbers here. We're down in the 20s and 30s. It's going to jump up significantly. There's the Psalms, a bit off the top. Exodus, notice the increase in the number of quotations. Here's Numbers. There's Deuteronomy, 234. And what do you suppose is number one? Leviticus. Yeah, this is a priestly group, and they want to know how to run the temple, right? So very interesting. We can do a couple of things now that we have this list to show us a little bit of personality here among these groups. Talk about the books that are in one list that are not in any of the other lists, right? So we have Jubilees and Enoch. We've already talked about these books. That more or less identifies this particular group. This is the group that collected the scrolls that lived there at the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. The New Testament, we have Jeremiah. Is the odd guy out. Now that's interesting because the New Testament is actually named after a passage in Jeremiah. Do you remember the New Covenant? So the New Testament, very interesting. So it definitely tells us something about ourselves here. Now if you've noted those that are odd on the Mishnah side, you can see Ezekiel and Numbers. And why those books? Because of the tabernacle in the wilderness. That was the center of their focus. And also Ezekiel was what? Ezekiel was a priest, and so we get some good priestly information. Just to center in on the top books in each side, notice the tie between the Qumran community and the New Testament. You know, top three books, those books that they were reading more than any other books, both the New Testament writers and Qumran, Isaiah, Deuteronomy, the Psalms. And one interesting thing we can say about the Psalms here, I think that when we in this day and age go to the Psalms, we most likely go to them for devotional reading, right? For Bible study, for our maybe our morning devotions, those times when we're feeling out of sorts or out of touch with God, much as David was often, we go to the Psalms for comfort. But what the quotations of the Psalms in the New Testament, what do you suppose it's centering in on? It's not devotional. It's messianic. You know, the quotations in the New Testament are looking for information about the Messiah. You know, that and seeing the fulfillment in Jesus. And in fact, the same thing with the Qumran group. What did they go to the Psalms for? It wasn't devotional literature. They were looking for information about the Messiah. We could spend the rest of the time just talking about that, but that's another talk. On the Mishnah side, you can see that just those books that we might have expected, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, right, the law, they were interested in the legal discussions. So you can see how these lists tell us quite a bit, not only about ourselves, but about the scroll collectors and also about the Jews, the Jewish groups that that collected and quoted the Hebrew Bible as well. Quite an interesting story. So as to the Yellow Pages, we are on the same page with the Qumran group, those of us that that are in the church to this day. So same Yellow Pages? Well, the church, yes. The synagogue, no. So it's a very interesting discussion that can be had thereby. Okay, now let's dive a little deeper. We want to know about the text, right? Is it the same text? I'm going to show you some figures on that, and then we'll look at a couple of passages, actually, where you'll be challenged to see the text as it was at that time. Because just first of all, let me show you a letter that I got from, this is Diana Johns, the exhibit coordinator down at Pacific Science Center. This came into me about a year ago as we were putting together some of the banners and some of the wall plaques. She says, another question, a quick one, is this a fair statement? This is what, this was the text that they had received to put on the plaque. Much of the biblical text in the Dead Sea Scrolls is identical to the Hebrew Bible as used today. And she says, I know that the texts haven't changed a lot, but this statement makes me nervous. You know, is it the same text? Well, we'll answer that question here now. This, and I don't want you to read this. Well, you can read it if you want to, but I'm not going to test you on it, okay? But this is evidence of a tradition that many of us are aware of. The Hebrew Bible, as it is copied in this era, you know, the time from Jesus onward, the scribes that copied the text became known as Masoretes. They were the ones that passed on the tradition, and that's what that word means in Hebrew. And they had some very specific guidelines that told them how to copy the text, philosophy of copying, if you will. And it went something like this, painting in broad strokes. You copy every single letter, and then you go back and you count every single letter. They knew how many letters there were in each one of the books of the Hebrew Bible. And in fact, as this particular quotation from the Babylonian Talmud suggests, they knew what the middle word was in every book. So that they would count the letters up to that, they would count the letters following, and if they were different, they would throw the text out and start over again. So very, very refined techniques of copying. You know, they were trying to become the Xerox machines of their day, basically. They wanted to get it just exactly right. And in fact, all the Masoretic manuscripts that that we know of from the 1008 manuscript on are exactly the same. You know, there are so few differences between them that they're literally you know, twins of one another all the way down to today. Now, as you've already seen, we've stepped back before this time, a different philosophy. You know, they still had, you know, they were shuffling the books of the Bible a bit. We can expect, I think, even without looking at the next slides, that the same thing was happening with the text to some degree as well. Now, I'm going to show you a couple of pictures here of manuscripts that are actually on display at the Science Center. This is the Genesis manuscript, and this is all that is left of it. So if you've got in your mind, again, that Isaiah scroll, all 66 chapters, we don't have all 50 chapters of Genesis. In fact, we have just this little piece of chapter 1, and it ends so poignantly. It says, "V'yivra Elohim et ha'adam," and God created mankind, and it drops off. It's quite beautiful. But anyway, this text, we can read through this, compare it to the text that we have from the medieval period, that 1008 text, and we come up with these figures. First of all, the date of this text. This dates to 50 BC, so 50 years before the birth of Christ. The fragment, from end to end, only contains 109 words. 4 words of those 109, or approximately 4%, so show some variation to the traditional Bible of 1008. Okay, so 4 words, about 4%. But those 4 words represent nothing but spelling variations. Now, I was born in the States, but I'm now living in Canada, and I've come to accept spelling conventions across the border, right? We spell color with a U. It's more colorful that way. We spell honor with a U. You know, it's just more honorable. We spell labor with a U. Work is harder, you know, when you spell it with one extra letter. It works that way across the board. So it's nothing more than these kinds of spelling conventions that we're seeing here. 4 words out of the 109, and all we see as distinct are spelling conventions. Now, it'd be nice if I could tell you the same story for every scroll, but let's look at one additional scroll. Before we do that, I'll show you where these four readings are, actually. There they are, all four of them. Probably can't read them from where you are, but believe me, that's where they are. Now let's look at this scroll. This is the Great Psalm Scroll, and this is the star of the show at the exhibition. This is one of the most beautiful scrolls from the finds. It came from Cave 11, and as you can see, this really does qualify for scroll, more or less. And we have a panel on display at the Science Center that contains a good part of Psalm 119. Now, before I go into some of the variations that we'll see in this this particular psalm, there's another variation that you need to know about. The scroll, as you can see it in the panel that's on display, ends with Psalm 132, and then it begins with Psalm 119. Now, that's interesting. The psalms, it appears, were still, you know, being shuffled around, and the rabbis were looking for the proper order. That is a very interesting new piece of information for those of us that read the Psalms and are looking for the plot, more or less. You know, that that says that the plot was discovered as time went on. You know, it wasn't there from the beginning. So the Psalm scroll, and I could show you about six slides that look just like this one. And so I'll just show you this one, and we'll move on quickly. But here are some variants that are found in the Psalm scroll. And it, as you can see already, has much more variation than the Genesis scroll that we looked at. In fact, we could look at it this way. First of all, this scroll is much younger. This dates to about the time of Jesus. Fragment has 152 words, or actually the text that is on display on the banner at the museum has 152 words. 45 of those words, 45 of the 152 words show some variation to the traditional Hebrew Bible. That's a lot. Now, if we just left it there, boy, we'd all go home thinking, boy, the Bible is one-third different in that period of time, right? But we can break this down, and it it gets better. 36 words are nothing more than spelling variation again. So we've got spelling that accounts for the lion's share of those 45 words. Two words have morphological variations. It's like different ways of making plurals. In English, we have different words with different ways of making plurals, like child, children, man, men, you know, that sort of thing. Those are morphological variations to the standard patterns. And we have two words that show some variation to the pattern that we see in the traditional Hebrew Bible. That leaves eight words with real variations. Now, most of these variations, I'm not going to show them to you. I'll show you one, really one of the more interesting ones. Most of these words, in fact, all of them except the one that I'm going to show you, I'm going to challenge you with this one, are variations that I would call secondary variations. In other words, they're reading the text as they copy it, and they say, you know, this would sound better if I put an and in here. Or this would sound better if I would repeat the name of God again, rather than just the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to say the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Those kind of variants are secondary. They reflect the type of Hebrew that was being spoken and read at the time that the scrolls were copied. But we do have a couple of variations, and I'll show you one here, I'll show you another one in a minute, that bear some thought, actually. And here, as scholars, we're now mining the scrolls for those readings that we assume are possibly better than the traditional Bible of 1008, right? Now, lest you think, boy, that sounds pretty scary, lest you think that we're just going at this willy-nilly, let me just tell you that in the New Testament, we have over 5,000 manuscripts, and the scribal job with these manuscripts is to search them all, to account for all the variation, and in every case, in every word, to choose the most likely word that reflects the earliest, hopefully as it left the pen of Paul, or as it left the pen of Matthew. And if you've studied Greek and you get the United Bible Society text, you can see all the variants listed in the bottom, actually graded. Now, before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we didn't have the opportunity to do that. We had this one manuscript that we used to translate into all of our English translations. Now we have 206 additional manuscripts, and by golly, we need to get in there and see what's there. You know, so that's what I'm involved with, and in fact, there are probably some here that will cap catch the fever here. This won't be just an evening that and you'll move on, but you'll be captured by this. And I bet there's at least one here that I'll see someplace along the line as you join in the discovery and become one of those that is actually a part of examining these manuscripts, because it's a great task, a lot of work still to be done. Let me just show you one variant here, and then we'll move on to the next question. This is the way the Psalm scroll on display at the Science Center reads for Psalm 119, verse 83. It says, "For you have made me like a wineskin in the smoke." The psalmist is in a pickle. You know, the psalmist he's depressed, frankly. And he is reaching out to God, and he says, "Oh God, you have made me like a wineskin in the smoke. You have brought this situation upon me, you know, and I'm coming to you now for aid." Now, look at the way the traditional Hebrew Bible reflects that verse. It says, "For I have become like a wineskin in the smoke." And the King James, the Jewish Publication Society, the NASB, the NIV, the NRSV have all translated the traditional Hebrew Bible. But I'm wondering, you know, the task that we have as scientists, more or less, you know, scientists of the Bible going into these biblical texts, is to ask the question, which reading explains the other? In other words, which reading is more likely the original one? And I look at this text and I think, you know, it's more likely that we were trying to protect God than it was that we were trying to blame God. You catch what I'm trying to say? So it seems to me that the traditional Hebrew Bible is maybe the secondary reading here. And the original reading was, "As you made me." And then the traditional reading becomes, "I was made." You know, certainly God didn't do that. You know, he couldn't do that kind of thing. So we've protected God in this, a very rabbinic sort of thing, actually. So this is a challenge, but you'll see that all of our modern Bibles, at least to this date, have gone with the traditional reading. But I wonder, you know, I do wonder about this one. So there is the lay of the land, so to speak, with the text. We've seen the spectrum of texts now at Qumran. There are 206 manuscripts. We certainly don't have time to go through all of them tonight, but you've seen the spectrum from those texts that are nearly identical. There is no text I'm aware of that is exactly identical, but nearly identical, right down to the only thing that is different are spellings. To the most extreme, that text like the Psalm scroll, that most of the differences are spelling, but there are a few that we struggle with, that as scientists of the text, I wonder whether or not we've actually stumbled upon the original writing from the hand of David. So same text, basically so, 99.9% of the time, but there are a few places where we will see some changes. So that's what we need to talk about now. How will modern translations change to represent the Dead Sea Scrolls? And in fact, we don't need to ask this question in the future, because whether you know it or not, your translations have already changed. So let me just show you one place where a change has been made, and then we'll talk again about painting with broad strokes here so you know how much difference the scrolls have brought to bear on modern translations. Here's Psalm 145. And actually, this psalm is found in that manuscript that is on display at the Science Center, although this psalm is not the one that's on display. The display text is Psalm 119. Psalm 145 is in another section of the psalm that is still back in Israel. But this psalm is a very interesting psalm because it's an acrostic. Now, do you know what an acrostic is? Alphabetic, right. It's an alphabetic psalm. It starts with the first letter in the alphabet, and every verse reflects the following letter. So we start out with A, and we run it through not Z, as in our alphabet, but T, as in the Hebrew alphabet. So from Aleph to Tav, A to T. And there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Now, I don't know if you can see the number at the bottom of the screen there, but it's 21. Something's wrong. You know, one of the letters is missing. And indeed, the end verse is missing and has always been missing. We've never had the end verse in our English translations. And scholars have wondered about this. You know, was it kind of an ancient hook, as it were? You know, as you write a verse for every psalm and leave out the end verse, it creates kind of interest in the psalm. As you, there's a bump in the road and you realize, oh, I was expecting an N and I got the psalmic instead. You know, that's the sort of thing that makes a song attractive after several listens. It draws you in. So is it an ancient hook that draws us into this psalm? Or was it a mistake someplace along the line by an ancient scribe that went to get a cup of coffee right in the middle of the verse, came back and picked up a psalmic rather than nun? We don't know. But the fact of the matter is, now we have a manuscript from Qumran that contains the end verse. And I'll show it to you. It's this. It says, "The Lord is faithful in all of his promises and loving toward all he has made. V'ne'man Elohim b'kol dvarav." Beautiful in Hebrew and beautiful in English. Now, you know, we're sitting here, we're thinking, I knew this before. You know, this is nothing, it's not going to change my theology at all. But, you know, if it belongs in this psalm, you know, I'd kind of like to have it back. You know, that's my perspective. And actually, there are a couple of modern versions that have added it back in. The NRSV, for example. The NIV, I don't think, has added it back in, if I remember correctly. But this is one passage that has made it back into some of our modern translations. Let me just show you the whole picture now. The New Revised Standard Version has been the most progressive in incorporating scroll readings, as you might imagine. It incorporates 85 readings in its most recent edition. The New International Version, this is a version that many of us use. How many use the NIV, just out of curiosity? Okay, so this is, how about the NRSV? Any of you out there? A couple. Okay, so the NIV. What about the NIV? Well, the NIV hasn't been quite so progressive or wild and crazy, depending on how you look at it, right? But they've incorporated 22 readings from the Qumran scrolls, 9 of which the NRSV does not include. So 22 that are not overlapping, but only partially overlapping. In fact, there's 9 additional in that 22. And it cites 11 readings in the marginal notes, 6 which the NRSV does not include. All told, this brings, in these two versions, it brings us to a total of 100 revisions that have already been made in our Bible as a result of the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, a couple of things here. First of all, there are some translations that will never reflect scroll readings just because of the nature of their philosophy of translation. King James will likely never reflect any of the scroll readings because they have established that 1008 manuscript of the Hebrew Bible is the manuscript that we are going to translate. The JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, as you can imagine, that's their traditional text. That's what we're going to translate. However, the JPS version I just discovered 2 weeks ago in a conference here in Seattle. There was a Jewish couple from Bellingham. They had the JPS version with the full notes at the bottom and the Hebrew text on the side panel. And that text actually is quite progressive in the scroll variants that it does refer to. So it won't be in the main text, but it is in the footnotes. Other versions like the NASB, which is the text that I normally use, it is about on the same wavelength as the NIV. So most of our English translations, the modern ones, have begun to incorporate scroll readings. The second thing that I should tell you here is that this is the 100 revisions that have been made already, as I say here, at a relatively early stage of the research. Now, what does that mean? You'll remember that I told you that there were only, excuse me, I should get a drink of water here, a little holster in here for the water bottle. It's really quite cute. I wish I could turn this around and show it to you. I don't know where the guns are. I don't think they're here, but they've got a water bottle anyway. So let me pause for refreshment here. Thank you. So relatively early stage. Remember that I told you that up until 1995, there were 7 volumes of the scrolls that had been published, official volumes. And since 1995, we have an additional 30. In fact, actually volume 40 has been published. So the scroll readings that are reflected in our modern translations up to this date go back to that 1995 stage. So you can see that there is much more new material that translators will begin to incorporate as time goes on. Just to approximate what we might see in the years to come, probably we'll end up with something like 400 to 500 readings that will be revised as we continue to study the scrolls. So again, as I scan the room here, I'm sure that there are some of you that would like to be a part of that, and we need to be a part of that, don't we? We don't want to give this to others to make these decisions. We need to be a part of that ourselves. So in some sense, you know, this whole question of canon, in a small sense, you know, the canon is still being established right before our eyes. You know, as we go to buy our Bibles, you're seeing these changes being made as we scour the scrolls for the variants that that perhaps represent, you know, that which Isaiah actually wrote or that which Nehemiah actually wrote. Well, not Nehemiah because he didn't write anything in the scrolls, right? But as Moses wrote in Deuteronomy and so forth. So very, very important stuff. Okay, we've got to move on. Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, the second of our issues here. This question always comes up. Was Jesus found in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, no. He wasn't found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in fact, as you've already seen the dating of the scrolls, they're too early, right? So we wouldn't have expected him to be found. But there's some very interesting information that gives us the backdrop to some of the messianic expectations that we see in the New Testament. And let me just, I'm going to walk past this slide and show you this one. This one is a document that isn't in the exhibit here in Seattle, but will be down in San Diego next fall. So if you like to travel and see the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see that one next fall. This just to kind of set the context here, we need to go back into the New Testament and remind ourselves of a story that I normally read this from Matthew. I like the way Matthew tells it in 11, 2 through 5. We have John in prison, and John is looking about. Certainly, things aren't good for him, and in fact, he's never going to make it out of prison. He'll lose his head in the end. And he gathers his disciples together, and he sends them to Jesus and asks the question, are you the one? Are you the one who is coming? In other words, are you the Messiah, or are we to look for another? And Jesus answers this, go and report to John what you hear and see. The blind have regained their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the good news preached to them. Now, this is both good news and bad news, I suppose you could say. The good news is, man, this is a great list of things. And we ask, how did Jesus answer this question? And I think most of us would firmly say, Jesus is saying yes here, right? But why didn't he just come out and say yes? You know, why the shopping list rather than just an easy answer? Well, that was more or less the pattern of Jesus' teaching, right? Very seldom came out with that quick and easy answer. He wanted to make us think. So that's what he's doing with John here as well. And we now have some information from the Dead Sea Scrolls that puts this in a bit of context. And I think highlights the answer that we're expecting here and that John was probably aware of in his time. So one thing I would need to point out to you, first of all of these elements that we see here in this list are those elements that are spoken of in the Old Testament as part of the messianic expectation, right? Except for the dead being raised. There's no Old Testament passage that particularly puts this in the Messiah's hands to do. The other things, the blind regaining sight, the lame walking, those things we do see in Isaiah and in the Psalms, but the dead being raised is an issue that has always caused the scholars to scratch their heads a bit. Now, here is the scroll that I showed you that picture earlier. This is the English translation, and it begins with the Messiah. For the heavens and earth shall listen to his Messiah, and all which is in them shall not turn away from the commandments of the holy ones. Strengthen yourselves, O you who seek the Lord in his service. Will you not find the Lord in this, all who hope in their heart? And it gets very kind of dicey there in the middle. We come into the bottom of the passage. It says, for he will honor the pious upon the throne of his eternal kingdom. Now get this, setting prisoners free, opening the eyes of the blind, raising up those who are bowed down, for he shall heal the critically wounded, he shall revive the dead, he shall send good news to the afflicted. Wow, that's pretty amazing, wouldn't you say? And this text is 50 years older than Jesus is. Okay, so this precedes Jesus by at least 50 years, and certainly it had been copied for years before that. And this portion of the text is virtually a lock on that which Jesus says in the gospel. Let me just line the two texts up side by side, and you can see them quite clearly. We have the blind regaining their sight in both texts. We have the poor with the good news being preached to them. We have the dead being raised. Now this, remember I told you, that was kind of the odd guy out because there's no place in the Old Testament that clearly says the Messiah shall raise the dead. But yet we have both of these texts saying that the Messiah will raise the dead, the New Testament and this Dead Sea Scroll. The one thing that it doesn't say in the New Testament, the one element that is left out is this very first one that we see in the scroll. And where is John again? And why did he probably question Jesus as to his ministry? Now, isn't that interesting? And actually, you know, there's a message here. You know, if we'd stop and wait until Sunday morning, I'd preach it to you. But there's a message here. You know, whether Jesus is saying, you know, John, get your eyes off yourself and take a look around, or whether he's saying, you know, this is not my ministry today, but will be in the end of time. You know, we don't know, but John is in jail, and Jesus leaves this element off of his list, but reflects every other element. Now, that's very interesting. So what is the answer to John? John may not have read this very text, but he probably was aware of this more or less list of messianic expectations, and Jesus now is certainly saying, I am the Messiah. This is what you expected the Messiah to do. Isn't this what I have done? So really fascinating. We could multiply this several times over, but that's one text that we need to be aware of. Let me just show you a few pictures now of other scrolls that are on display at the Science Center. Whet your appetite, and then we'll open it up for some questions, give you the floor for a change. The non-biblical scrolls that are on display at the Science Center very nicely tell the story about the group. In fact, I've told my students, I've told other groups that I've talked to, that if it were only these 10 texts that we had, we would be saying much the same thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls as we would with 900. There are very few things that are in the 900 that are left out here. We don't have any Aramaic texts on display, nothing from Jubilees or Enoch. But aside from those couple of holes, we really have a very nice story that we can tell. And the non-biblical texts, I'm going to kind of center under four questions that we can ask, that we ask today, and the ancients also asked. We ask, we search the scriptures, they asked, and they searched the scriptures. How do we fit into the biblical story? We want to know today, you know, what's happening in the world around us, and how does that fit into the prophetic picture? We have a couple of texts on display. One is a commentary on Hosea, the oldest commentary known to man on the book of Hosea. In fact, that was one of the surprises that came out of the caves. We have a couple of dozen commentaries, and they're all on prophetic books. They loved the prophets, and they wanted to know what the prophets were saying about their very time. So this text quotes Hosea, and then it says how this is being fulfilled right now as we live. Very interesting text. Another text that is on display at the Science Center is Pseudo-Ezekiel. Now, that's kind of a strange name. Why Pseudo-Ezekiel? Well, the ancient Jews loved to write books in the names of biblical characters. And this book is more or less written in the name, or at least the style of Ezekiel. So if you read Ezekiel and you have questions about what you would have liked Ezekiel to say, or questions that you would have asked Ezekiel were he still around, that's basically what this scroll does. It steps into a discussion of various issues, kind of fall between the cracks in Ezekiel. The very right-hand side of this document is important because it's the first discussion of the resurrection from the dead. It makes it quite clear that the understanding at that time was a physical bodily resurrection, which is so important to both Judaism and Christianity. So how do we fit in? They wanted to know the same. We want to know, how do we tell time? Well, maybe we don't want to do that, but they wanted to know how to tell time. We've already decided these issues, some very important issues. Like, for example, why is it that Hanukkah seems to wander about? We never can nail it down. You know, it's someplace around Christmas time, but never quite the same time. And how about Easter and Passover? Man, that's a mystery too. And speaking of Easter, how do we date Easter? Does anyone know, if you didn't have a calendar for next year, how would you figure out when Easter is? I'm hearing, I know some of you know, it's the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox, right? So that represents a discussion someplace in antiquity when they fought this out. We want to know about time. You know, we want to know in the Christian community, the Jewish community wanted to know as well. And actually, there's a more or less a calendar war going on at this time. And in the scrolls, we see one calendar that was opposed to the calendar that was in the temple at the time, that calendar which is still the calendar of the Jewish community today. The Jewish community today, the Jewish community of antiquity, the standard calendar was a lunar calendar, 29 and a half days per month on the average, 354 days total. That's why these things wander about. So the calendar of the Qumran sect, of which we have a very beautiful representation, this is probably a fragment that you've seen published in various of the newspaper articles, quite a beautiful fragment. This is a listing of all the festival days and accounting for their take on the calendar, which was solar, a 364-day calendar. Not quite ours, but fairly close. And nice because it's divisible by seven. You never have to worry about what day of the week your birthday's on. It's always on the same day every year. Kind of nice. Okay, so we wanted to know about time, and that's in the exhibit. How is the world going to end? You know, that's something that that we think about to this very day. We search the biblical text for that information. And this fragment, which is one of a larger group of fragments that's on display, goes into just that bit of detail and talks about the war at the end of time, where there will be seven battles fought, three that the sons of darkness will win, three that the sons of light will win, and then the Messiah, God's emissary, comes in and wins the day for the sons of light and establishes the kingdom. This particular fragment, if you had your Dead Sea Scroll ears on in the fall of 1991, this fragment was actually published in the press and came to light with a fair amount of fanfare because it was claimed at first that this particular fragment revealed a crucified Messiah in the century before Jesus. And that's kind of one of those, you know, the holy grails of biblical studies is trying to find evidence of a suffering Messiah before the time of Jesus, and it doesn't appear to exist. So when this seemed to show it, it captured the public attention in the fall of 91 and was in all of the newspapers, but unfortunately, the tables have been turned, and the text almost certainly, as you'll see on the display at the Science Center, says just the opposite. In fact, it says that the Messiah is going to put the leader of the sons of darkness to death rather than the Messiah being crucified. He's doing the death sentence. So a very interesting text. How is the world going to end? And then we'll end here. How then do we live? And they ask the same question. And there is the very first text that you see as you come into the scrollery at the Science Center is one of the community rules texts, and it answers just this question. How do we live as Jews in this time period? How do we live as God's children? And they went into quite a bit of detail as to what one must do to join the group, how one stayed a member in good standing. And this is a picture of that manuscript. And as we move into question time, I will put this up, and those of you that want to do a bit of reading, this is the display text that is on the banner at the Science Center representing this fragment, and a beautiful text it is. And I think as you read through it, you'll see that 2,000 years may have passed, but this is still pertinent to us today. Thanks, Rick. Thank you very much.